Great teaching happens when teachers get time to think. Walk into an Educate classroom and you'll find a consistent approach to homework, teachers who know where knowledge gaps are, and students who are doing regular retrieval practice. With Educate, you can be free from marking homework by the end of the week. Students have now answered over 1 billion questions on Educate. If you're looking to set up centralised homework and revision in your geography department, you won't be disappointed. Your first month is free at www.educate.co.uk/geography.
Hello there, thanks for joining me today for another JogPod. I'm joined by Sarah Smith and Hazel Metcalf, both with long careers in teaching, some in primary, some secondary, and both with a passion to enable young people to appreciate and better enjoy the outdoors. If you're a geography teacher interested in the outdoors and particularly about rivers, landscapes and chalk screams, then this is going to be one for you. Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
It's an enormous privilege to be here too. Thank you. And this opportunity has given me the chance to reflect on the richness being a geographer has made to my life and being able to share it with children too.
Good morning. I'm delighted that after 2 years of the project running, that we're able to share it with you and to set it in a wider educational geographic context.
Yes, because we're going to be talking about the Chalk Stream Challenge, which is a fantastic resource. I've really enjoyed looking through that. And if I was a teacher, I'd be definitely looking at that and using it. And not just in a chalk stream situation either, but we'll get to that. We're going to be talking about that later. But Sarah, I want to start with you first, because you told me that virtually all your teaching has been in primary and infant schools. You're now retired, but you haven't stopped. You're still working. And when we were talking earlier, you gave me this quote, which I thought was a lovely quote. You said, "I was a student when I was warmly encouraged to read the landscape and consider the relationship between landforms, vegetation and land use." I love this idea of reading the landscapes. And I get the impression that's been a thread throughout your teaching and throughout your personal life when you've gone on for walks yourself. You're always reading the landscape.
It adds such richness to life. I'm thinking particularly, well, just a few years ago, had them for a bike ride along the Monsell Trail. And that is absolutely superb. You've got the engineering through the limestone and the tunnels and the viaducts and the huge expanses of that, the sort of more historical geography things about how the railway was diverted and the wonderful platform cover for the Chatsworth Estate. You see orchids, you see volcanic intrusions, and you see a tea room as well. So it's been that sort of thing is fabulous. And even during lockdown, when you were allowed out for an hour back in those days, my husband and I would get a map and a compass, and we would go on to bits of heath we'd never been on before. I mean, they were no different to other bits of heath, but it was just exciting to go and take a straight route and see things through and find what was going on in there. And even our heath is very rich, because you've got the plateau gravels, you've got the heathy mires down below, you've got a huge range of stuff. So you can find everything from fossils to armaments. You know? So it just makes life so much more exciting. And yes, I have tried to show my children and other people's children the same. It makes the world a much better place to be in.
I was standing at the top of Monsell Head. We were cycling on Tuesday, and our route took us to the top of Monsell Head and then down through Monsell Dale, up the other side, and then back through Lytton to Sheffield. It's just a wonderful landscape. You started, didn't you? Your student dissertation was looking at channel morphology, but not in the north. That was in the south, wasn't it, on a chalk stream in the south?
It was on the chalk streams. It was in Hampshire. It was on the River Meon. And I learned, obviously, a lot about channel morphology and its difficulties of studying it from models and maps and things, especially as the only textbook I could get in those days used the Mississippi as its example. And I was also had three very happy summers with the Hampshire River Authority, as it then was, now the Environment Agency, and we looked at the wells to draw the map to get the water supply, how much we were going to have. And actually, that was just on the cusp of whether we got plenty or whether we were going to run short. And now we've got this enormous aquifer in the south and thinking of having to have a desalination plant on the coast. That is really shocking. And that the people, some of the people whose wells we visited were so proud of them. They wouldn't touch mains water, but now it's polluted. And that is truly tragic. And it's so sharp how things have changed in half a century. And so we need to bring this to everybody's attention in every way we can.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there to pick up on, I think. I mean, talking about trying to compare the Mississippi to a chalk stream is just crackers. So it brings us, which something we'll talk about, I think, the problem of textbook examples and the reality of fieldwork. That's one. And then the second, a sense of place, a sense of how each different individual piece of landscape has a different set of explanations and a different set of responses from people, because they are so different. Chalk streams are different from streams on granite. It's of understanding place and difference, I think.
Yeah, yes, very much so. And models are fine, and they're a good starting point. But especially with young ones, you get your hose pipe and you put it down the playground and you begin to get your sound-generated curves and so on. But then it hits a stone and it goes out of kilter. And the chalk streams, they're so heavily managed. It's really difficult to find somewhere with meanders. It's partly management. I mean, I'm thinking of the headwaters of the Arles and the Cheriton stream. You start in a boggy patch on the Arles, then it goes into a lake. The outflow comes from one side, and there's a teeny weeny tributary about 50 yards away on the other. You'd think it goes straight into the lake. It doesn't. It comes round. So then you're walking down a road and you've got the river coming clearly one way. Then you suddenly see it isn't. It's coming at 180 degrees. And you have to really look at that. And then there's another little tributary. It's 400 yards long. You never see the source because it goes straight into a crest bed, a series of stepped crest beds, round a corner and into a trout farm. And then Bob's your uncle, it's in the mainstream. So you can't do any normal, so to speak, channel morphology on that.
Yeah, I want to come back to that because that's so important for students to understand. But Hazel, I want to bring you in because we haven't spoken. And I know you two have been great friends for years. You met as students in the same hall of residence and have been friends ever since, as well as professional relationship. You've got a strong personal relationship, and you've got a geography A level. You are reading history, so we'll allow that. But you've actually spent a lot of time on that crossover between history and geography, which is where I am too, to be honest.
I think so. I think I would say really humanities are my interest rather than either history or geography. But obviously, for a degree, you have to choose one. So I chose the history. And in fact, that's been one of the strengths of our friendship, I think, that we bring both the history and the geography to it. And so in 2019, when we celebrated our 50 years of friendship, we actually went to Winchester and looked at history within the city. And then after a very good lunch, we went and walked in the water meadows of the River Itchen. So it kind of all tied together in that one day, which summarised our friendship.
You've done work in both primary and secondary, haven't you? So I think, Sarah, yours was all primary. And at the end, your school got the primary geography quality mark. But Hazel, you made that crossover and have worked in secondary schools, and you've worked at university too.
I have, and in a further education college, yes.
Yes.
Those were towards the end of my career. But the reason I suppose that I was able to cross over so easily was because when we trained, middle schools were predicted to be the way forward in education. And so there was an opportunity to train for either 9 to 13 or 8 to 12 schools. But apart from a few counties, those have never materialised. But it did mean that it was relatively easy to cross between the phases. When I was in primary school, of course, I taught the humanities, including geography, and led field work with classes. In secondary school, I was working in special needs. And so as Senko, I was able to join many of the fieldwork trips, particularly down to the Jurassic Coast, which was an annual pilgrimage for the geography GCSE groups. And so I've also, you know, I've managed to actually step into geography throughout my career, including when we've run activities weeks. And I ran a summer school for gifted and talented children at one time. All of those, I was able to engineer the activities to my interest to a certain extent.
That's interesting, because that leads us really into chalk streams, I think, really, and field work. The bulk of chalk streams actually globally are in the UK, aren't they, as I was reading? And then France comes quite a long way second. But before we talk about chalk streams straight off, I'd like to chat to you both about what you see as the value of field work for students.
It's just so liberating for so many children, because you don't have to read and write in the conventional way. And it really gives some of the children a chance to blossom and to show others what they're capable of. I taught for a lot of my time, I taught in a deprived London Overspill school, and those children had never left towns, let alone been in the countryside. So it was such a privilege to go with them on their first trips and to, you know, show them how to cross a field, show them how to climb a stile, show them how to enjoy an adder basking in the sun, watch a frog, all those sort of things. And then they could stand up in front of the whole school when we'd done some meanders on a river and show them how they'd done the map and everything. And everybody sort of sat with their mouths open that these people could do it. And we've done with so many other things as well. The children I taught were the only ones who knew all the names of all the trees on the school field and what sort of things they needed. And that's because they're very good visually. So it was easy for them. And that's just so wonderful. And Hazel was talking about engineering opportunities, and chalk streams are brilliant for that. And mentioned to a boy who's rather glassy-eyed about say the word engineering and they get ever so keen. And well, there's loads of things we can do there. So I really do think it's a fabulous opportunity to get the best out of children who might not otherwise do it, as well as everybody else.
Hazel, what was your experience as a Senko? Did you find, what was the enthusiasm like for teachers that you were working with for fieldwork? If you're like Sarah and you've got a passion for it, or like you and you've got a passion for it, it's a no-brainer. We will take those students out because it has such value in terms of helping them understand themselves within the landscape and grow as human beings. What was it like with other teachers? Did you find the same positivity, or was it difficult?
I think there have always been teachers who have been very keen to take students with special needs out into the environment, but there have also been many others for whom that was a daunting project, and so they didn't want to do it. On my final teaching practice, I took a group from Gosport across on the ferry to Portsmouth with a very young history teacher who was extremely keen to do that, but didn't have a lot of support in the department for taking this small group. I think there were probably about 12 of them. So we did that, and the change in the confidence of the children, who actually they notice a lot of things about the environment. So they were able to inform us, because they are often not bothered, you might say, about the reading of the labels or anything, the sort of discussion about it. They just observe. So sometimes they are in a wider group, greater ability range, they're able to contribute, which, as Sarah's just said, is a huge benefit for them. But that, I would say, continued one of the last trips I went on was when I, with another history teacher, passionate about taking all sorts of children out, we went to London to the Imperial War Museum. Two of our children had medical conditions that made that quite precarious, and in fact had small incidents while we were out, but we coped with them all, and the day was again a huge benefit to everyone. So I think people shouldn't be put off by that. And of course, we're talking here before we retired, so we need to remember that inclusion has gained momentum over those years, and whilst it's still perhaps not as widespread as positive as it could be, the situation has changed. So hopefully for the better.
Yes, I think so, from what I pick up. And I want to pick up on something else that you've said there about just observation and how students are unexpectedly sometimes better at observation than we give them credit for. And we must not be too tempted to control them by having them record all the time and keep their eyes down all the time. Sarah and I were talking about the importance of looking up and the importance of experiencing what's going on rather than being too focused on gathering results.
I think the clipboard management sometimes becomes the dominant feature of a trip for particularly smaller children, which is a shame, because then they are concentrating on that and trying to keep up with their peers on filling in the worksheet rather than having time to look around.
I'm not sure it's just smaller children, actually, to be honest, because when we did our first river studies, I'm going a long way back now, when I first started teaching and took them down Burbage Brook, which is near where I used to teach in Sheffield in the Peak District, we, to begin with, were more concerned with collecting the width, the depth, the wetted perimeter, so that they could produce some results and create nice graphs at the end. And I was walking back with a bunch of students. It'd be the second or third time we'd done this. It took me a little while to work this out. But they didn't realise they were in a valley. We'd spent all this time just looking down and measuring the speed of the stream. And that was why eight students. So I think it can be a problem for all students, this idea of giving them the space. It's easy for me to say, because I'm not doing GCSE anymore, but giving them that space, I think, is really important. And I think, Sarah, you'd agree, wouldn't you, that that's a key thing for developing their appreciation of the landscape much more.
Yeah. And I mean, things you can sort of do a bit of field work in the classroom almost. I think if children have kneaded clay and poured water on it and got a huge lump of chalk and poured a watering can of water, where has it gone? And then done it with a piece of granite or whatever, you get a feel for what sort of things you should be looking for. You've done a bit of an experiment about it, and they thoroughly enjoy that sort of thing and found some fossils and a bit of limestone. So you can, you know, do it in a bit more controlled way to get yourselves going, because it is very scary for people who are not so confident to go out into the landscape and not have the control of the clipboard to, you know, we've done it, we've got something to show what we've done. But as Hazel said, it's controlling the clipboard. And as you said, you can be so busy filling it in. I just sort of, as we were talking, I wondered if there's a virtue in having a member of staff purely to be the clipboard monitor and write down results of everything of this and that that one might want back in the classroom. And then that frees up everybody else to do more, be more engrossed in their experience. It's just a thought. It might work for some people.
That's a pretty good light bulb moment, actually, because there are always some students who haven't quite managed to sort the results out. And we're now moving on to the next place. Some students haven't finished yet. Hazel, with your humanities head on, it's also an opportunity doing some work, like Sarah was saying, in the classroom beforehand, to develop a language for what you're going to see when you get out. If you haven't got the right words before you go, it's a little difficult to express what you're seeing, I'd have thought.
And I think that often people feel they should simplify language for children, particularly for younger children. And my experience has been that is not the case, that if you use the correct vocabulary and rehearse that with children, they enjoy rehearsing it themselves and are proud of the fact that they know the correct term, that they can share that with parents or other teachers or other children, and they relish those skills, in fact. So when talking with the chalk streams, for example, the word sluice has proved to be a favourite one. It rhymes with juice, and you can make silly sentences as you're walking along the river. But they then, when we see a sluice, they are more focused on what it does because they've had that explained before. Other vocabulary has different connotations. For example, they love the word louse because they know something about what lice do, and probably have all had nits anyway. But that has a kind of morbid fascination. But it does mean that when they see a louse in their dipping tray, they know exactly what it is. And even more difficult words like camouflage, when you're looking at a cased caddisfly and trying to talk about why you can't see that amongst the gravel at the bottom of the stream, a longer word like that seems to stick in the memory much better. So I think that's important to use the correct terminology and, as Sarah said, to rehearse it before you go if you can. And really, it's just about sharing language with children at every opportunity. And in this case, it's the language of the river.
Yes, I endorse that because one of my roles was to teach language to people who hadn't got very much. And really, to rehearse it, I found I had a vast quantity of postcards I collected over the years. And those proved extremely useful, especially with, you know, the seaside ones. You had the cliffs, you had the beach, you had this, that and the other. And any collection of pictures that you can build up is so useful, because for a really language deprived child, you need to use a word lots of times over several weeks in context, build it up. And then you have to expect them to begin to use it, to get it firmly into their vocabularies. But they do really enjoy having the proper technical terms for things and places and so on. It gives you a sense of power, I think, to know what it is.
I think that's the value of, as you were talking there about lots of photographs as well, lots of images, because one valley doesn't look the same as another valley. And I do remember, this is another bit of a light bulb moment for me, but when I was first teaching A-level, there was a perfect question on glaciation in the exam with an arete and a corrie. And when my students came out, I said, "Oh, wasn't that fantastic? That was just the perfect question for you." And a couple of them said, "What do you mean?" And it was, well, it was a corrie and a arete. And they didn't recognise it because it wasn't the same as the photograph that they'd seen, because it was a long time ago. We're talking the 80s. It wasn't the one that they'd seen in the textbook. So I thought, "Oh, crikey, we're going to have to show them lots of different examples of these things, because they don't all look the same. So they need a vocabulary, but they also need to be able to see these different things, because a valley isn't always the same as another valley or another valley. They're different things." That was a real eye-opener for me, I'm afraid, because a couple of them just hadn't answered that absolutely perfect question. I made sure that they had lots of different images then, as well as the words, to explore and to use and to deepen their own knowledge and understanding. So now let's talk about the Chalk Stream Challenge now, because it is such a fantastic resource. Hazel, you and Sarah created this in a volunteer role.
We did. We've both been members of the Trust previously in our sort of 20s, but also we've joined again a decade or so ago, and gradually we have become more and more involved in volunteering, particularly with the educational officer, because there are places there that, such as the Fun Fridays that the council organise in Andover through August, such as obviously the challenge subsequently, but also the Trust organises things where volunteers can contribute. Obviously, there are many other ways you can contribute. My husband volunteers in a forest coppicing, but he also counts riverfly. So there's a huge range of opportunities, and we've gone for this one of education because obviously that's where our backgrounds are.
Being a member of the Geographical Association, the professional organisation for teachers of geography, isn't only about your journals, or your teaching resources, or your discounts on CPD events and webinars, or your member-only prices on books, maps and geography equipment. It's about connecting to your peers in the largest geographical education community in the UK, which reaches out and has more than 10,000 members all around the world. Join the GA. Visit geography.org.uk today.
How did it all start? What was the moment when this began and it developed into the Chalk Stream Challenge, which I should say, actually, you could use the resources on any stream, really. And
definitely,
it's important, isn't it, that we look at chalk streams because they are so rare and they are landscapes to be preserved. But if I'm a teacher sitting here listening to this thinking, well, I haven't got a chalk stream anywhere near, it doesn't matter. The same resource can be used. It's just that it is the specialness of the chalk stream that has led you to this.
This began when the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust were planning to launch a project to preserve the chalk streams. And so members were invited to a meeting to discuss ways that we could persuade people to A, get out and enjoy the chalk streams, but B, to look at areas in the upper reaches of the Test and the Itchen, which were at that stage rarely visited by people, with the intention of spreading the load on the river banks and the rivers themselves across a wider range of stretches of the rivers. And obviously the smaller tributaries are much more accessible for people, particularly from the point of view of getting into them to dip. So I went along to this meeting and not a lot was decided at that one, but a subsequent meeting was arranged to come up with ideas for ways that we could engage the public with the chalk streams. One of those Sally's worked on quite a lot, where they have something called open streams. And Sally has conducted tours that she'll tell you about with adults along those. But at this particular meeting, I began to see that as ideas were put down onto a huge sheet of paper, there was nothing for younger people. And because I've been involved in guiding for almost all of my life, and I have both written challenges towards a badge and obviously helped my brownies and rainbows over the years to be awarded badges, the idea came to me that this was something that would work for this particular project. We were writing the bid for the lottery funding at that time, so we didn't actually know that we would be able to carry on and complete any of this. But nevertheless, I decided that I needed help. And Sally, as a very long-standing friend and obviously geographer, was the ideal person to ask. So on a very long car journey, when I'd had a foot operation, so she had to do the driving, we actually completed the planning, which obviously we've taken forward and subsequently became the Chalk Stream Challenge.
I'm going to say that the third person that's been introduced into this isn't a person really, because your name for Sarah is Sally, isn't it? It's like a...
I thought I'd be really good about remembering this morning.
No, that's not a problem. You also brought in Sarah's sister, didn't you? Because it became bigger than this, and we were talking about the need for imagery, and Sally's artist sister was also involved.
Yes, she put our two designs together, and anyone who's seen the badge will think, well, that is a very low, flat bridge, because chalk streams with their little variability in flow often have very low bridges. So that's a characteristic, and a brick bridge, because that's our local building material. And then it's got watercress in front, because that's part of the industrial uses, and flag iris as a waterside plant. So there's quite a lot of depth in that picture, in that badge picture.
And the flag iris is the emblem of the project, because eventually the funding was awarded and it developed into a project called Watercress and Winterbournes, which is why that's what the challenge is called now.
And the Chalk Stream Challenge is part of that whole project.
It is, yes.
So to talk me through what that exactly involves. What does it look like? If I'm going to go onto the website, What do I see, and what was the underpinning thinking behind it?
The thinking is that we realised parents needed support if they were going to, and uniformed leaders, because remember, this was designed not for schools originally. And so we tried to put together a list of activities that would cover what we felt to be the important ones you needed to know about chalk streams. So the challenge you can apply for just by going to the website. You don't need a professional with you from the trust. You can do this completely independently, which is why you can apply it to any other area. And in fact, it's spread now to other areas. The Chilterns are looking at it, and the Norfolk Wildlife Trust are looking at it. It comes in 5 sections. And the first one, which everybody needs to complete, is to walk a stretch of the chalk stream. And as I'm describing this, remember, it could be a stretch of a very different stream if that is what is in your environment. So you could be mentally picturing somewhere you might use for this. Then there's a section called geography, where we look at flow and measure that in the river, the clarity of the water, which of course in the chalk streams is beautifully clear. We investigate the properties of chalk, which Sally's already described. We talk about the facts, and here photographs are really important. We show people pictures of the winterbournes at very different times of the year, because of the fact that the water goes down into the aquifer. The rivers often don't flow until the middle of winter and often dry up again in around May. So they're quite special in that respect. And that covers many of the upper tributaries of the chalk streams. We talk about watercress production there as well, which in the modern age is probably the main industry on the chalk streams. There's a section on river life where we ask children to look for wild watercress, along with a warning that it may be contaminated, so not to eat that. Obviously, they look at the fish, the plants, the mini beasts. They talk about life cycles. They talk about food chains. And a particular interest of Sarah's, they look at the flowers and the trees. She's amazing at remembering all the names of those, which as a country, my child myself, I'm embarrassed to say I'm not very good at. The fourth section is about industry and land use. So we look at the man-made structures. I think Sarah's just mentioned bridges. I've mentioned sluices. We look at the brick watercress beds, the older ones that you can still see in many stretches of the rivers, but mills. And we encourage people to visit a watercress bed. You don't have to do all of these things. There is a structure that suggests how many you would do for each age group in order to achieve the badge. We talk about tourism, drinking water being taken out of the stream. Beer and gin are both made with water from the River Test. I won't mention names of distilleries, but two quite famous ones quite close together are using the Test water. We talk about farming, and we talk about the nature reserves. And the final section we've called fun, but we hope all of the challenge will have been fun. But we play poo sticks, and it's amazing how many parents don't know how to play that. So for the children to drop a stick in and watch it come out the other side of the bridge and shriek with excitement when theirs is first is a very new experience, because it's not in the family tradition. They taste watercress from a bought source. And we found giving that with something like cheese in a sandwich is the way that everybody will then give it a go. We race boats that we've made out of leaves. We collect shades of green to make a colour chart. And obviously we draw pictures and maps. But if you go onto the site, you'll see how many of those things are recommended. Though when I've completed the challenge with rainbow units, I found we almost touched on all of those one way or another. Maybe, Sarah, you could describe where we have set up the routes, because we found that people lacked confidence, didn't we?
Yes, we've set up...
Before Sarah starts, that's interesting, because you just talked about the lack of confidence, the lack of knowledge that not just the children have, but the parents have too, which means that they, like you just mentioned about the poo sticks, there's no frame of reference for students to learn these sorts of things through their own parents, through their own walks, because they're not doing them. Because your comment was that you observed that many parents, this is an interesting one, are afraid of wild spaces such as riverbanks and rocky shores, perhaps because there's a heightened concern for dangers to students, perhaps to young people. And the more structured education since 1988 is something else that you cited. So all these things were constraints to be overcome.
Yes, we definitely felt that, and we feel it very strongly. A fact is the Oxford English Dictionary no longer includes words like buttercup and oak. So we have moved on from needing to know about the natural world, and that makes Hazel and I very cross. But also, you notice on trips and things, parents and assistants will often get their phones out, or even a day in school, which makes me really cross. It was happening when I was there. They get out their marking. We've got an expert to do it. We're not involved. Well, that's telling the children it's not important. That's not being prepared to learn alongside. It's all sorts of things. I've been on a guide camp, and suddenly you've got a 12-year-old holding your hand because it's dark. So you immediately have to build in more night hikes. We've got to build resilience in children. It's terrible to be so scared of your environment. You've got to teach them how to behave. So we show them how to get into a river, how to test the depth before you go. And you know, with the rainbows, you've always got somebody on the bank. You've got an adult with you at all times. We have been trained in water safety, so and not to go in, you know, anywhere near a sluice or a mill or anything like that. But it's quite all right to go in over the top of your boots, which with small children is inevitable. That is fine. It is fine to get wet. It is fine to get muddy. That's not a problem. You dress for the occasion. You have dry clothes ready, all that sort of thing. So it gives a whole new dimension to life. And Hazel was mentioning stings and all that sort of thing, weren't you, Hazel? You had a great long list of things that children aren't taught to engage with these days.
Because they don't often go out into the countryside.
Yeah.
They fear, and that is an inherited fear often from their parents, who again, because since probably the early 80s, children have not been so free to roam the countryside as we all did and discover things for themselves. So if they get a scratch or a bite, they think that something terrible is going to happen to them, whereas we would have found a dock leaf and rubbed the nettle sting with that. And in fact, they enjoy doing that now. So if you can work with them, then it's not that there is a difference in children, it's in a difference in the way that they have been educated right from very young. The lack of clothing is a problem, because a lot of children, even though we both live in semi-rural areas, many of the children go everywhere by car, so they don't have Wellington boots, they don't have puddle suits, they don't have raincoats. And so I think that means that parents are reluctant to take them out. And actually, the parents don't have that kind of equipment either. So, but once they get over that, as Sarah said, it's fine. The first time I took a group as a pilot of the challenge, it was the wettest October Saturday, and we took almost 50 5- to 7-year-old rainbow guides to Whitchurch, where we got off the bus, and on the short walk across the Millennium Meadow to the dipping site where we were meeting a member of the trust, it rained. And the children began to trail back. They complained about the rain. They complained of getting wet. And then we saw the education officer for the Wildlife Trust. I pointed her out and we waved to her. They started to run towards her. And when we got to the stream and they found they could go in, they were ecstatic. They got water in their Wellingtons. They got it inside their puddle suits. They got it. Somebody sat down. They were completely soaked. And nobody between that point and getting off the bus in the village complained about being wet. So there are different sorts of wetness, and children really enjoy the wetness you get from engaging with a river. Mm-hmm. So I think that the more we can encourage children to go out, the more we are giving them transferable skills that will fit them for the rest of their lives.
And I found when I was in charge of the year six trips for those who didn't go on the residential, we would go on three walks as part of the week, not more than 10 minutes from the school to the start. Nobody had been on all of them. Only a few had been on one of them. And one was a bit of wood behind the local football pitch, one was a bit of heath, and one was up a hill. It took us nearly 2 hours to walk up this hill because of all the exciting things we could do on the way. And what was the real triumph at the end was one mother said that to her son, "You can choose which one we will go on and take a picnic." I thought that really is beginning to get people out. And by the end of the, 5 years that I did them, I regret to say some people didn't want to go on the residential because it was so exciting going on the trips at home, which, you know, it is a widespread problem, this. We would love it to be much less so.
What you've done, I think, is that you've taken this issue of children not getting out into nature enough and considered that and the relationship between them and their environment. But you've also thought through, I think probably because of your long experience, the pair of you, but also the quality mark that you've done, Sarah, to think through the geography, the language and the experience, so that these are not simply nature walks at all. You do the chalk stream challenge and it's very much a geographical and holistic experience, so that they come away with a much rounder experience than even if they'd just done a nature walk, which, as you've said, is so important. You've elevated it beyond that into something that enables them to read the landscape, to go back to your words at the beginning, yeah, in a much more effective way.
And I mean, there's so much which would be of interest at secondary and even, you know, an A-level sort of things about perching the rivers because of water abstraction and water warming due to climate change and so on, and an abstraction which has a vast knock-on effect on trout and salmon, the pollution due to field runoff, septic tanks, sediment getting into the river. And that's an interesting one because the Trust has just started up a citizen science thing. Mark on your phone where you see sediment going into the river. Well, that will be a real plus to secondary children, let's say, these days, who are getting more environmentally concerned, that they can have an effect there and then as they walk along the bank on their field trip, watching road runoff and so on. Even things like topical flea and tick treatments we wanted to mention, because that is a pollution off your dog going straight into the water. But if you give them ones you eat, that will stop that effect, instantly killing the insect life. Even duck feeding, and people, as Hazel knows, gets very uppity that feeding bread, loaves of bread you see going in, is certainly not to be recommended. It pollutes the water. You feed them lettuce and so on. So that's one of the things we do with the little ones. It's a bit of duck feeding. So there's so much to do. And that's before we get on to any of the engineering aspects. And I know I've taught lots of glassy-eyed boys. And as soon as you say in river engineering, you know, they begin to get going. So you can do about mill wheels and overshot and undershot and breast shot, the different effects, as well as water meadows, which are massively interesting things. And whether water meadows can now, that sort of concept can be used in a more environmentally friendly way to get water onto your fields than those great big spray arm things, all sorts of things. And we have longer routes for older children, so they're in the wider valley aspect and they can use a map and all that sort of thing as well. We've tried to make it a framework that you fit to your needs.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking, actually, as I was looking through this. I did do field work with my students in Lathkildale, which is a limestone area, but it counts as a chalk stream, I think. But I'd also be thinking about closer in, where I am in Sheffield, to Rivelin Valley, which is much engineered, but engineered in the 18th century for water mills. They're all ruined now. In fact, sometimes you can't see anything apart from there'd be a pond to one side. So when A-level students are looking at that, or GCSE students are looking at that, it's not instantly explainable. It doesn't fit the textbook.
No.
So it's just odd, but it gives them something to think about. Why is it like this? What's going on? And what I want to try and do, and I've said this before on other podcasts, is to encourage them to realise that because it doesn't fit the textbook, it's not wrong. There's something else that's gone on, and let's see if we can try and explain what that something else is.
Yes.
Which brings back to you, Sarah, and the engineering.
Yeah. I mean, when you're thinking of Sheffield, the Abbeydale site with the steel knives, with four different water wheels coming off one mill pond, is absolutely brilliant. Spent a whole day there. And the children in the photographs emptying crucibles, that was truly shocking. That's beside the point a bit, yes. And I think even young children are very keen to make hypotheses and check them out. And right, their answers might be wrong, but if they're thinking, trying, working things out, that's what science is all about, isn't it? You're not right all the time, and you test it out and you work it out. And I think that's really important, that you do it for yourself and you're not just told that this is the textbook, this is what it should be, or that's not a good example, we'll do something different. You know, as you say, you've got to think about it.
I have a book by an academic who's dead now, sadly, called Barbara Kennedy, who many of her chapters are about how geographers have got things wrong in the past, including the debate about glaciation or the flood, not glaciation, what's caused this landscape. So geographers, eminent geographers, have got things wrong throughout history, and we're constantly creating new knowledge. And I think that's a lesson for students, for young people, for children to learn. We're running close to our time now, but there are a couple of things I'd like to ask you. Do many schools take the challenge as part of a residential? Would this be something that would fit to that sort of set of activities? So I can just take it and use it elsewhere on a week-long geography residential if I was doing that.
I think it'd be fabulous myself, yes. Yes, I think that would be an awful lot to offer, yes.
I don't think we've heard of anyone doing that, have we? Maybe that's a challenge for people listening today.
Yes, that's what I was thinking, because you can just, the resource is such that you can just lift it and apply it anywhere.
And even the activities that go with that, you could adapt to whichever environment you were working in. So some of the craft activities, for example, you could change the nature of the drawing, but you could still play the same game. Duck feeding is duck feeding wherever you go. And the duck feeding game is brilliant.
And then tying it to Ofsted is something where you'd have to look and say, where's this geographical? And where are we biological? Where is this biology? Where is this science? Where is it geography? And then make sure that if you're putting an emphasis on the geographical element of it, then you strengthen that part of what you're going to do. If you're opening it up as a much more open challenge, then you would choose different elements. Would that be right?
That would be right, because you could, in fact, achieve the completion of the challenge by heading through a mostly historic route. So it's entirely up to you to follow your interests if you are doing this as just working through the challenge rather than wanting to adapt it to fit your curriculum. But both ways are perfectly possible.
Yes, it did. It struck me as it being so that there are so many resources that I as a teacher can pick, choose, strengthen some aspects if I want to, but I've got all the underpinning there to enable me to do it, to give me the confidence to do it, because it's got the examples. And it's a sort of ready-made fieldwork package, a holistic package.
It is. And if you are within the Watercress and Winterbourne's catchment areas, there may be support available from the Trust. So we both go out helping on river dipping mornings, for example. So it would be worth exploring that. And that sort of help may be available in other Wildlife Trust areas.
I think as two volunteers, you've done a wonderful job with this. It's been absolutely amazing going through the resources and thinking, crikey, you two have put this together in the way that you have. And it's such fun, but so worthwhile as well. What's given you the most satisfaction about the project?
Well, I've got two little sort of snapshot scenes. One was with a little girl who was desperate to join Brownies. She was a carer, she was a bit back, and her gran thought it would be nice for her to go out. So we went out. We did the whole challenge in Alsford, but we stood by the watercress beds and we watched an egret picking out worms. We watched a water vole scuttering along. We looked at head agrimony and watched the bees and why you had the biological things about it. And that was one. And then the other was with my grandson over from Canada. He'd never seen a swan. The rivers he sees are absolutely gigantic, the North Saskatchewan and so on. And we had such fun hurtling up and down the bank, you know, timing our leaf and our twig and which is faster, is it doesn't make a difference? All these things, which are sort of basic science. He was 8. And all the people on the tarmac bank at Winchester were laughing at us because it was obviously such fun. So those are two things that stick out for me. And Hazel's got lots of examples as well, I'm sure.
I think for me, the most exciting thing has been the reaction of children in particular, of all ages, but also of adults, to discovering more about their chalk stream. And I'm sure that would apply to any other kind of stream that you might use. So I think that's probably the most exciting. There are so many examples of children who were reluctant to either get into the water or reluctant to put their hand in the dipping tray or to even use a spoon to take out something from the dipping tray. And then through a little bit of persuasion, you find out that by the end of your session, the ones who you are having to repeatedly ask to pack up and come and join you or get out of the stream are those who in the beginning just lacked the confidence to have anything to do with that and just wanted to be observers. And I think if you can hook them somehow with just a small thing on an activity day, then you possibly have hooked them for life. I do actually know of a geography teacher who decided to become a geography teacher because I took him to a nature reserve on an activity day about 20 years ago. So it does work.
That's a real shame for geographers, I think, for geography teachers and primary teachers who teach geography. That's such a powerful message. You're not going to say this, so I am, but 460 young people have taken that challenge in the last 18 months. How wonderful is that? And you've won a Hampshire and Isle of Wight Naturalist Trust Wilder Award for introducing young people to chalk streams. It's a fascinating resource. All of this will go onto the GA website at the same time as the podcast, so teachers have got the opportunity to follow up and read up on what you've done, which has just been wonderful. It's been fantastic chatting to you both. Thank you very much for the opportunity today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.